Hello and welcome to episode 8 of Crosshairs Radio. Today we talk to Dan Chabanoff. Dan is on the Richard Sack Cyclocross team. He was in town in Washington, D.C. racing DCCX this past weekend. He was a guest at our house, so I took advantage of that opportunity to sit down and talk to Dan. We talked after a full day of cyclocross racing at the Armed Forces Retirement Home in Washington, D.C. It was about 10:30 at night where we sat down for a conversation, which, despite all of that and us being extremely tired, turned out pretty good and was animated, and had a really nice time talking to Dan. We got into a lot of different topics that you'll hear, including the state of U.S. cyclocross, you know, what it's like to be an elite pro cyclocross racer racing for top 10s and top in C2s and top 20s and C1s. So it's a little different perspective than we've gotten in the past, and it is a wonderful conversation with Dan. Once again, you can support this show by supporting everything at cxhairs.com, and that's about it. Let's talk to Dan. Ask me that question again.
What do you want to talk about, Bill?
I don't know. What do you want to talk about, Dan? We could talk about you starting in cycling.
Oh, man.
We could start about how, you know, at one point in your life, you were a rock star in cycling, and then you wanted to, like, go race on the road and go race cyclocross.
I don't know. I keep forgetting that was the... You're talking Red Hook, right?
Yeah.
I'm guessing. That was the only point in time where I ever felt like a rock star.
Let's just go back even from there. You know, Dan Chabanoff, where'd you grow up? How'd you get into cycling?
All right. I was born in Russia. I lived in Moscow up until I was 7 or 8. Moved to Arizona for a year, went back to Russia, lived there for another year, and then I ended up in Jersey. Did middle school, high school in New Jersey. I was a swimmer in high school.
What was it like going from Moscow to Arizona?
I mean, I was like 8. Yeah. I was just like, desert, okay. You know, like it didn't...
Did you speak any English?
Well, yeah, actually. I spoke pretty good English. My mom has a doctorate in English. So she's an English teacher. She actually still teaches English to this day. She teaches ESL. Mm. Immigrants teaching immigrants.
Right.
It's kind of cool. And we start English in first grade. You know, so it's like, you know how you go to elementary school and you have one teacher?
Yeah.
In Russia, you have one teacher and then you have an English teacher.
Okay.
And you have an English teacher for 12 years all through school. So most people speak some, if not good, English. And then I watched a lot of Disney movies with no subtitles.
Perfect.
So like The Lion King. What was the one with the dog and the fox?
The Fox and the Hound?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That movie was traumatic as a child. Anyway. So yeah, then high school in New Jersey, ended up going to college for photography at School of Visual Arts in New York. Met a bunch of bike messengers, got a part-time job as a bike messenger, decided that I didn't want to go to college, cause I was a little frustrated with art school. I don't know. SVA is very commercial in my opinion. So it was a lot of like, this is how you plug in strobe lights in mm-hmm. a studio. And I'm like, I can just read that in that manual. Anyway, ended up doing that. Was messengering full time. Ended up going out to casino with a bunch of coworkers. There was like a Wednesday night in New York track series. Ended up racing that. Got a steel 8-speed road bike from somebody.
So when you were messengering originally, were you doing it all on a fixed gear bike, or were you just
I mean, there's a point in my life where I owned like 3 track bikes,
yeah,
no road bikes. I mean, like, I think the first time I rode to Bear Mountain, which is like the big road ride that New Yorkers do, it's like a 100-mile round trip. We did it on track bikes because we're idiots. I don't recommend doing that to anybody. So yeah, ended up doing track, a little bit of road. I sucked at road. I sucked at track actually too, but I was slightly better at road than I was at track. And then I bought a cross bike off a coworker. It was too big for me. It was a 59 top tube.
Oh, man.
And I had an 80 quill stem on it because it was like a threaded
right.
fork. Good gracious. Steel Bianchi.
Yeah.
I raced that bike until I got my Cat 2, actually, which is hilarious. I tried cross and it was just like immediately, I think my first race I got second. Then I won a couple of races. So it's kind of easy to be into something that you're naturally good at.
Right.
Kept doing that. That was like right. So my first season's racing cross was 2008. I won the Mac B series in 2009.
Oh, okay.
2010 was my first elite year. And I think 2010 was also right around the time I won the Red Hook Crit for the first time.
Okay, so you were doing this concurrently.
Yeah, all these, I was kind of like coming up, I guess, through the ranks, like the categories. Mm-hmm. And then when I won the first Red Hook Crit, I was still a Cat 3 on the road, I think.
And for those who only follow cyclocross, can you explain exactly what the Red Hook crit is?
At this point it's grown to be a 4-race track bike brakeless criterium race series all over the world. There's a stop in Brooklyn, there was a stop in London, a stop in Milan, and right. Barcelona this year. And it's become insanely competitive to the point where, I mean, there was the Barcelona race had a guy from Cofidis racing.
Right.
The guy that won the series this year was a former Sonier Duval rider that started Milan San Remo in like 2007, you know? So it's like, I mean, I definitely think at one point it was like this very like, look at these hipsters being cute, you know? But at this point, it's legit.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. They've actually taken this quasi-legal race that happened when it first started and made it into a legit business.
Yeah, I mean, Dave is an incredible race promoter. I mean, he was working at the time when he started, he was working for his like uncle's architecture company, and then he went full-time doing that. And from the get-go, he had a knack for it, and I think the thing that really separates his series and gives it like this fan appeal, this like thing that people go nuts for, is like he really goes out of his way to like create rivalries, some that are real and some that are imagined. Like he would write, like leading up to the races, he would do these like very scathing like previews for each rider, you know, and he would like somehow find a way to jab just the thing that like he knew would hurt, you know.
Amazing.
And like it really made the race super stressful, but at the same time, you know, people bought into the drama, you know, people were really, you know, and I feel like that's a lot of what's missing from like professional cycling is that like, I mean, it almost, Dave creates this almost like pro wrestling drama,
right? Yeah,
you know, where absolutely. Like these people have these like things against each other, you know. And in cycling, we in pro road racing, it's like people shaking hands and like being good sportsmen, and it's like.
Well, I think that is actually the one thing that makes Belgian cyclocross special, in that it does have that world wrestling, you know, part to it, and everything is a story. Everybody's private life is a story. Every little thing that's said is dissected and taken apart. And, you know, I think it really, really does have a little bit of that. And that's why, you know, people are just nuts about it.
I mean, I think that's a big part of why it's so successful in Belgium, because it is very much a soap opera for them, you know. I mean, definitely I would say people care about the sporting aspect of it, but when they have these other dramas, it gives it so much more depth.
Yeah, for instance, the controversy over Sven not being disqualified 2 years at Cross Vegas. For us, it was sort of like, oh, this is something interesting intellectually to talk about, and should he have been disqualified or just, you know, fine. It was just like on every tabloid, and that's all people were talking about, and the, you know, the media knew, and they just blew it up into this huge thing, and it's like, yeah, that's what drives the sport, and that's what makes it popular. So
sells newspapers, yeah. Gets eyeballs, yeah. Makes people lots of money.
Absolutely.
You know.
All right. So you were doing the Red Hook Crit. How many times you win that?
Three times in a row.
In a row. Anybody matched that feat since?
I don't think. I mean, there's people. I know Neil has won more races. In general, Bezdek, who rode professionally for Smart Stop,
I think, yeah,
several years, but maybe like 2 or 3 years ago. He's probably got more wins total, but I don't think anyone's won it 3 years in a row. And I think the way that it's going now, I don't think anyone's gonna. It's gotten really insanely competitive.
Yeah, so around that same time, also the other crown jewel, the Bielanki Junkyard Cross, also taking those wins.
Oh yeah, I did that. I did that 2 years in a row. But that's I don't know. I think I don't. There was some guy that was like writing blogs around there, around that time, and he like. I can't remember what the name of the blog was, but it was somebody on like Kelpis Cycling. I think his blog was called something offensive. So I'm not going to repeat what I think it was called, but he like dubbed me the hipster king of cycling. And then it like got around and he like actually reached out to me and like apologized.
Yeah.
And I was like, I don't care. That's like, it's cool that, you're like writing about me for reason.
As long as they spell your name right.
Yeah, more or less. It's not that hard. That's exactly how it sounds like. But yeah, so yeah, did the Red Hook Crit, and then 2011 was my first season with Richard Sachs.
Richard Sachs, right.
And that was, yeah, that's pretty much where I've been in cyclocross since.
And so tell me a little bit about the Richard Sachs House Industry experience, the team. One, you're riding these custom bikes. They're steel bikes. A lot of people would shy away from that. You know, just what's the appeal? What got you in? How did he even contact you to get you on the team?
Well, that's kind of actually an interesting story because so I was working in high school. I worked at a bike shop. It was a town over from me. And every Friday night, they had the regular bike shop guys would get together and have beer night.
Mm-hmm.
And they made their own little jersey. They were all older guys. Some of them used to race. Some of them never raced. They called themselves the Fat Men.
Yeah.
And at some point they got together and pooled some money and put their logo on the Richard Sachs kit. They were, I think 2009, they were on the shoulder panels.
Mm-hmm.
They had their logo there. I'm not sure if anybody noticed, but they were just doing it for fun. And so when I started doing well in cross, they kind of kept following me after I moved out and started doing my thing. And they sent Richie an email about me.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
And at first he thought I was a master's guy because he was getting this email from these guys that were older.
Right.
And they referred to me as one of the fat men.
Sorry, we got some like noise.
That's
in there.
Fine. I'm sure you can fix. You can fix that in post.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So okay. So you're a master's racer,
apparently. and so we were sending emails back and forth, going into the 2010 season, and this was like maybe in May, and eventually it came down that basically he was full. At the time, he had JD, what's his, God, I always called him JD. I can't believe I forgot his name.
I'm not sure I remember who.
Josh Dillon.
Okay.
Josh Dillon was on the team. Will Dugan was on the team.
Right.
And
Spinelli
was on the team.
Oh, interesting. That year. Okay. Yeah.
Spinelli crashed really hard at Gloucester. That was the end of his season. Will Dugan signed with Team Type 1, went pro continental, and basically told Richie last minute that he couldn't race cross. And so he was down to one person that season for a lot of it. And over the winter, I sort of stayed in touch, strategically parked next to him, made conversation.
Smart.
Introduced myself to Deb. Basically, if you're trying to get on any team, the person that runs that team needs to know who you are and needs to remember who you are, so when you do something in a race, they like see it, because otherwise you're pretty much invisible, no matter how, you know, unless you're winning the races, in right. which case everybody knows who you are, or some people. A very small subset of people know exactly right. who you are.
Exactly.
The general world couldn't care less. Anyway, and so then going into 2011, I basically reached out to him, made it clear that I was still interested, and it ended up working out. And my first year on the team, it was me, Josh Dillon, Christian Favada.
Mm-hmm.
The next year is when Timmerman came out of retirement,
right?
Came back, and that was really fun racing with him
for
2012, 13, and 14. Yeah, 3 years.
Yeah, in the beard years.
Yeah, the beard years. At one point, there was like a Facebook account for his beard.
Really?
Back in the like the beard heyday.
Yeah.
In like 2008, before he retired for the first time.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I'd say the general vibe of that team is very familial.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Richie's really interested in having people on the team that sort of like are with it, in the sense that like results are important and they're great. But the number one thing for us is like, you know, we have people that invest in us and the sponsors that give us money, product, whatever. And that's our number one thing, is like, we do everything that we can for them. And if we get good results and we make some good memories together, that's awesome.
Yeah.
Those are the things that matter, you know,
yep.
out. And like, those are the things that we value as a team over anything else, you know? So it's like, it is a little weird though, because it's like, you know, Richie has a wait list that's years long.
Right.
He's not trying to sell any bikes.
Right.
This is like a interesting example of what goes on, is like, we have a sponsor, Rex Chu. He's a physician in California. He's mm-hmm. not advertising his business. He's not advertising anything. He just wants his family name on the kit because he's a fan of what Richie does and he just wants to be a part of it. And like, I would say that 95% of the sponsors that we have, that's what they're there for. They just want to be a part of what the team is doing. They couldn't care less if we're winning the races or if we're not finishing the races. They're not in the cycling world,
right? They're almost patrons, almost like they just want, not even that, they just want to be part of it. They want to be
part of the thing that Richie has spent 40 years cultivating, which mm-hmm. is this very like sweat the details, you know, handmade. I know what I'm trying to say, but I don't have the right words for it. But
I think you got it across.
It's a weird, I mean, it's not a typical cycling team.
No, absolutely not.
You know, in many, it's typical in the sense that we all have the equipment that we need.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the frames are a little different than most people are used to, but they're certainly competitive.
Right.
You know, I mean, as Timmerman proved last year, and I think as Britley has proven this year, it's, yeah, in cyclocross, a pound here, a pound there, just doesn't really matter that much. You know, it's like we have top of the line wheels from Cole that they made specifically for us.
Mm-hmm.
We have great tires from Challenge. I mean, we just, we have everything that we could it's as modern as it gets.
Yeah. And you got so this year you also have Sam O'Keefe riding with you. He's a guy that us in the Mid-Atlantic have watched grow up since, you know, I think, you know, however young he was when he started racing, 10 years old.
I was duking it out with Sam O'Keefe in 2009 for the MAC B series.
Well, yeah, there was, I remember when at Charm City, possibly before that, I was racing in the Masters race, the juniors, or some junior field. I want to say it was U19. I feel like it was farther, it was older than that. But yeah, I feel this guy behind me. You know, we started like a minute ahead of them, and I feel this guy behind me like keep trying to pass on the inside, and I keep sort of like shoving him into the tape a little bit and not let him go. And finally, after about the third time, I just hear, "Bill, can I just get by?" And I look over my shoulder. I was like, "Oh, I didn't know it was you, Sam." Of course.
Well, you gotta, you know, as a junior, you gotta learn that, like, passing on the inside.
Yeah. Yeah.
Unless you have room and you're carrying the speed, it's not going to work. That's a lesson.
Like, and it was. It was like, you are absolutely faster than me, but I'm not letting you get by. But then,
right.
Yeah,
right.
But, you know, of course, he wasn't, wasn't in the same field. So I was like, yeah, go do your thing.
Sam is great. We also picked up Libby White. Mm-hmm. So we have me and Britley are, quote unquote, the senior riders on the team. And because Libby and Sam are both U23 still.
Right, right.
They're both in college. They're both balancing school and racing. So yeah, it's also really, it's really nice to have the team be balanced with young riders. And it's also nice that the team has two women on the team and two guys on the team. It's just, it was cool because we had a new sponsor come in, this year with things, which is just like this French brand that makes, wearables, like smart, like Fitbit type stuff.
Okay.
But French, so it's like well designed and doesn't look like a Fitbit. Take that, Fitbit.
Shaking in their Fitbit boots.
So they came on board, and, yeah. And actually they came on board the same way. They were just like, "We just want to be a part of this. This is really cool. We like what you do." Which is a great way to have sponsors come. It's
oh, absolutely.
It's totally not the norm to have sponsors come to you.
Right.
And then the Mark, the guy that is sort of in charge of that in North America, he's like, it's funny, like, seeing what he's putting out on social media, because if you listen, if you read what he's saying, it's like he feels lucky that he landed us.
Right. Yeah.
As somebody he's sponsoring, which is like, normally it's the other way around. The teams are like, "Oh my God, we got this amazing sponsor. It's like allowing us to do all this stuff." And it's reverse. And it's just like another one of those ways in which, yeah, it's not a typical team. We've also, according to Richie, we've never lost a sponsor. We've had people stop making the thing that we were using, and that was like the only way that we had to get. So like Cole, Cane Creek stopped making wheels at some point a couple years ago, and that's when we switched to Cole.
Right.
We'll be riding Cole wheels until Cole stops making wheels.
Nice. Road racing? You still doing any road racing?
I actually got fired from my road team this year because I didn't race that much.
And is that okay?
Yeah, I'm fine with it. I told him at the beginning of the year that I didn't want to race as much, and, you know, difference of opinions.
Right. So day to day, are you, I know a year or so ago you sort of made the jump to being a professional cyclist. You wanted to do that full time. Is that still it? Or are you, you know, supplementing income anyway? You know, what's your week look like?
I mean, I still have a day job. Mm-hmm. Richie is, you know, the team is great, and I have everything that I need. If I didn't live in New York, I wouldn't need a day job.
Right.
But because I live in New York City, I still have to work.
Yeah, I mean, for a living. even at the, you know, when we're talking, we just did day one of DCCX. We're gonna have day two tomorrow, and you see a lot of the people you're racing against in this race who are coming up from, say, North Carolina, many of them, or Virginia, you know, in places that they can survive without having to pay a lot. You're coming from New York City, right? A little different story.
Well, I'm pretty lucky. Last year, so I was working on the bike up until basically the fall of last year.
Okay.
I quit messenger work in 2012, and then, but I was still doing food delivery in Brooklyn up until, yeah, last fall, when I started working as a coach for Endurance Works in New York.
Oh, okay.
And that's really allowed me to, I mean, it's a lot of work during the summer particularly, and during the winter when we do indoor classes and stuff. But right now...
So what kind of, what does that entail? What kind of work is it?
Well, coaching in New York City is a little different than coaching in a lot of places, because I feel like we do, a lot of our income also comes from doing the indoor compu training classes, bike fits, you know, a lot of client rides. So it's a lot of, I kind of still have to come to the office a lot.
Right.
Whereas like, the guy that coaches me, he just, internet. You know, he's at home.
Yeah.
He's, you know, he interacts with his clients remotely.
Right.
But in New York, I feel like you can't really get away with that, mm-hmm. just because, you know, if that's all you're offering, then there's no reason for other people, for people to not choose like someone somewhere else.
Right.
So it's a lot of, you know, coming into the office. And when you have an office that's also a client service space, you kind of have to be there to maintain it. Somebody has to like sweep the place. So during cross season, I get away with working 3 days a week.
Okay.
So I have Fridays and Mondays off.
Right.
To travel.
Yeah.
Do openers. You know, I basically get to be a pro bike racer 4 days a week, and mm-hmm. then the other days I, you know, have a more regular job.
That seems like not a bad balance.
Yeah, it's working out pretty well so far.
So racing wise, what are your goals?
This season has been going really well.
Yeah.
I can't complain. My fitness is really good. I'm definitely the fastest I've ever been racing cross. I'm the most consistent I've ever been from Saturday to Sunday, week to week racing cross.
Yeah. How old are you now?
28.
Okay.
Yeah.
You get screwed up by the racing age.
Yeah. I had to like said that. I say that and I'm like, am I 28? I don't know. So yeah, it's been going really well. This is my fourth top 10 UCI top 10 result this year. Been a little bit frustrating in the sense that I've had a lot of bad luck. Like today I had to pit twice for mechanical things, and that took me out of the lead group.
Yeah, because you were like right on the tail end of that lead group, and then it sort of knocked you down to that next chase group.
Yeah, I mean, it happens.
Right.
But it's, you know, it's like anytime you have good legs and you have an opportunity for a good result, and something takes that away from you that's not biomechanical failure of some kind,
right,
you know, or bad form, or like user error, whatever, you know, you get a little, it's a little upsetting.
Yeah, absolutely. For sure.
But I, you know, I feel like I'm a guy that's, you know, top 10 at the regional C2s. You know, when I go to the C1s like Providence and Rochester, those races are just hard.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you looked at if you saw the results from Rochester, like 23 guys finished one day.
Right.
I mean, that's just a really, really tough course, too. So the gaps get a lot bigger, you know.
Yeah, a lot of climbing. Like, those hills look just insane.
Yeah. I mean, it's like 2,000 feet of climbing in an hour.
Yeah.
You know, so on a faster C1 like Providence, you know, I'm finishing on the lead lap fighting for top 20.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I'm fine with that. Honestly, I'm happy where I am on the team that I'm at, and they support me, and I can do this. You know, that's really,
right.
Really, that's all you're hoping for as a bike racer, is to just like be able to do it
right
as much as you want. And I'm able to do that. I think my goal for this year is a top 20 at nationals. I've gone to nationals. I went to nationals in Bend, 2010, mm-hmm. both years at Madison and Boulder. I skipped last year.
Good call.
Yeah. And I've never finished on the lead lap at nationals. I don't know why. In Bend, I think it was just like I was way in over my head. But yeah, I don't know why. Ever since they moved it to January, it's been harder for guys that live somewhere cold and have to train through the holidays,
right, I think.
But yeah, I want to get that out of the way. I was really close in Boulder. It was crazy. They pulled us with two to go, and I think I was placed like 23rd.
Yeah.
You know, which is like...
Yeah, that's
I'm
rough.
In the third group.
Right.
You know, they're like, Powers is way out ahead, and then there's like a Chase group two, and then my group. And I'm just like, really? You're just going to... I mean, I get it. It's nationals. It's about the guys that are on the podium. Yeah.
But Powers is like busting the curve for everyone.
I mean, he's been doing that for a few years now, and it's great, you know? I mean, he's a great ambassador for the sport. He's really likable, and I don't know if you can say anything bad about Jeremy.
No. And you're actually going to be hanging out with him in November.
Yeah, he's coming to New York.
Yeah,
you two are doing a thing at
we are doing
Cycle
it the
Club.
same week. So yeah. He is going to your cross practice on that Wednesday.
Our little local Wednesday night cross practice on Randall's Island. That's going to be fun. It's going to be a little weird. I have a feeling we're going to have a lot more people turn up.
Right.
Which I think it'll go over fine. Nobody from the Parks Department or the cops have bothered us this year, and we've had like 40 people out there on a regular basis. So, but it's like kind of cool because actually cross practice is like how I got into it in like 2008. When it was like Jed Kornbluh and like CJ Jammet. I don't know what his last name is. It's CJ. He promoted the Staten Cross race for a number of years before Sandy took that park out. Those guys were doing cross practice and that's how I got into it. So it's like, I don't know. It's cool that it used to be like five or six people.
Right.
Back then. Yeah, and now it's like 40 people and we're going to have the national champion come hang out. Like it's pretty nuts.
Yeah, that is. That's crazy. But you know, that's sort of how cross has gone too, just in the growth of it, you know, even from that time, it's just sort of everywhere. It seems to be crazy. Of course, national champions aren't showing up at everybody's practice.
No, no. I mean, it helps that the Rafa has a store in New York.
Yeah. Yeah. So yeah, we're doing a event with Jeremy on the 12th, so they have that day after, so that should be fun too if people
want to hear your glorious voice some more. I won't be there. I'll be at work. Actually, no, I'll be driving to Philly to hang out with my girlfriend.
Priorities.
Yeah. No offense.
That's okay. I understand. We get this night together.
So yeah, what else?
You know, we started talking about the soap opera and the drama of cyclocross in Belgium, but you know, we definitely have a little drama discussion points. There's a lot going on,
mostly on Twitter.
Yeah,
mostly
on Twitter. So I guess the biggest thing that's out there right now, the biggest Twitter and social media discussion points, revolves around if we need a national series again in cyclocross. You know, ever since why am I blanking on what it's called?
USGP.
The USGP.
It's ever late. Since... You've been up since like 5 a.m. promoting a UCI race.
Yeah.
I get it. I mean, it's almost... look at the time.
Okay.
Don't look at the time.
No, we're fine. We're good to go. sleep sometime. Yeah, so that ever since the USGP went away, and you know, on one hand that gave a lot of other promoters the leeway to do what they wanted to do with their race because it wasn't controlled by one entity. On the other hand, it sort of left us without a top level series that was manageable. The Pro CX right now is 40 plus races in it. It's not manageable. It's going to be the guy who races the most in the, you know, Pro CX that's going to win it.
Right.
With results. Right. Races who's, you know, gets the best results.
Consistently.
Consistently. Right. Right.
So I'm going to just say right off the bat, I don't have an answer for this.
I don't think anybody does.
I'm not about to solve this problem for anyone right now, but I do have some opinions about it. I think when the USGP went away, it definitely decentralized cross in a good way. I think it allowed for a lot of growth. A lot of new events popped up. Because the thing is, the USGP, like, you couldn't compete with it. You know, you couldn't, unless you were an event on the other side of the country, if there was a USGP in your region, like, no events could basically happen. Everyone went there. And that's a good thing, but it's, I don't know.
Well, it's tougher and tougher now since so many events are out there and there's so many little events.
But at the same time, you know, it's like, I don't know. There's no conflict with DCCX. You know, there's a race up in Canada.
Right.
Which I don't know why. I mean, people went to that race too. But it's like, for the most part, you know, particularly on the East Coast, it's great.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, this is my fifth weekend of racing UCI races.
Oh yeah, in a row.
Within driving distance.
What I found interesting, you know, promoting this race this week, a UCI race, the conflict that I ran into with a lot of the elite racers that I tried to get to come down here was rest week.
Right.
You know, because since he's coming up, the Pan Am, and it just worked out with everybody's schedule that I had no idea. I guess if I knew more about, you know, elite level training plans, I would have seen the ebbs and the flows of it. But so many riders, this is their rest week.
But, you know, but like, here's the thing, not to take anything away from anybody, but it's like, there's going to be a handful of guys are going to go to Cincy with a hope at getting a good result.
Right.
Right. Whereas it's a lot, you know, for most people, it's like a lot of money. It's a lot of travel. It's a big expense to get to Cincy. Whereas like, if you're on the East Coast, driving to DC is cheap. You're putting me up for the night.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's like my rest week is next week because I wanted to do this swing of five weekends all in a row.
Right.
And then I wanted to take off. And it's like, yeah, Cincy would be nice. But it's like, for a guy like me, you know, I got 10th today.
Yep.
Right. Yeah. I could go to Cincy and I could race and finish on the lead lap. And like a top 20 would be a good result. And that's not nothing, but I don't know if I want to travel that far.
Right.
That, like, I don't know if it makes sense for me, for my ability as a rider, for the team that I'm on. I think, you know, a race like DCCX makes more sense. It's still a professional event. It's on the Pro CX series. I can get a good result here. I can, you know, it's like the fans at the race were amazing. I mean, it was one of the bigger crowds I've seen all season, including Gloucester, including Providence. I mean, the finishing straight was lined with people. I was giving high fives. You know, it's like, I most of the time, no one's even sticking around for the ends of the elite men's races because they're finishing at 5:30.
Right.
You know, like, people want to go home.
Yeah. And I love you saying that. And that's, you know, one of the things that we tried to tell people is that because of the location of our race, because we are in a city and people can ride their bikes to the race, and yet it is still this amazing venue that you can get into and you can have a good time, you can eat and everything, that it's 5 minutes from everybody's house. So it's just, it's a good hang. And
I mean,
you know, we get that those fans in there.
Not to get off topic, Pro CX, I think what's, you know, it's like, I don't know if we necessarily, you know, like, you got to think about who it's going to help to have the professional top level series again. It's going to help the household names.
Right.
You know, it's going to help Powers, Driscoll, Ryan, Hyde, White. You know, it's going to help those guys, Timmerman, Dodge. Like, I'm going to forget somebody and then they're going to get mad at me. but it's going to help the, you know, the guys that are top 10 at the C1s, you know, and that's great. I think raising the overall level of cross is overall going to be a good thing. Treating it more professionally is going to be a good thing. But at the same time, I think there's a lot to be said for just treating any UCI race as a professional event, covering it like a professional event. I think that is going to do overall more for the sport if more media gets involved, more people are covering the races as they are now. I get it that it's like this sprawling calendar and maybe it's hard to keep interest, but there's still drama every weekend.
Yeah, and you know, today's race, for instance, which did not have a lot of those top names, some of them that you mentioned, yet, you know, without Powers a minute up on everybody or Hyde, you know, chasing him and just having those two, we had Cam Dodge and Timmerman and Ben Frederick and Ben Burden and Lindeen trying to chase on, and yourself who was there, and Marion trying to catch on the back of that thing. And you came into the final lap and there were, you know, Lindeen dropped off. You had a group of five and it went down to a group of four who that whole lap were racing against each other the whole way, and it meant something and it was exciting.
Right.
And that's the type of thing that you're going to get if, you know, you have that ability to have more people doing that if you have the C2s out there as opposed to,
I think, you know, is having a professional series again a good thing? Sure. But is there more that we could be doing to make the sport better with what we already have? I think that makes more sense to me as a guy that's doing the C2s and is like, you know, not somebody that's making a living
right
at this, but someone that's getting by doing this. And I think the majority of the people doing the UCI races are in my boat, not in the boat of like, yeah, we need a series so we know where to fly that weekend.
Right.
You know, I mean, the easy solution is to take all the C1s and the Pro CX, make that a series.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they already sort of do. The Pro CX hinges on the C1s because the points for those are weighed so much more heavily than the C2s. So it's like, if you really want to win the Pro CX, which by the way is $40,000 yeah. of a prize purse, I don't know why more guys aren't focused on this. And I don't know why guys that are like complaining about not having a series not trying to win the Pro CX, because it's a lot of money.
Yes.
You know, it's like, if you need a series to focus your season, go to all the C1s. Damn. You know, it's like, done. There's your season. Fly to those races. But I mean, at some point we're probably going to move in the direction of either resurrecting the USGP or.
What do you think at this point? That's even going to be possible, because after the USGP went away, you know, all of these promoters were able to do their own thing, were able to sort of dictate the direction of their races and figure out what they wanted to do. And one race may be different than another race. You bring in the series and then you're going to have to somehow get control back from those races. And somebody's going to have to come in with a plan that's pretty convincing to bring all of that under one umbrella.
Money. They're going to have to come in with a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's possible. I don't know if it's how likely it is. I don't know how much it really makes sense for American cyclocross. Mostly because, like, you look at Belgium and it's like, okay, they have these two big series. They have the Super Prestige and the B-Post Trophy, right? And all the races are within like a two-hour drive of where all those guys live.
Yep. Well, it's like the Sunweb team. I was talking about like the world-famous grassroots local team.
Right.
You know, they don't want to travel.
Yeah.
They just want to do their races in the Super Prestige and the B-Post, and they want to gripe if they ever have to even go to the Netherlands, you know.
Right. And so it's like, it's easy to have all the top riders at all the races there because they're all so close to each other.
Right.
It's like, it's the same way that like, New England racing is stacked because there's so many good riders that all live within a 5-hour drive.
But then even Belgium, even these huge names, these heroes of the sport that we look at and you're thinking, good Lord, there are so many professional riders in Belgium. How many line up at the that actually in their nationals, unlike ours, you have to be a pro with a contract. Otherwise, you have to be making a living riding your bike. How many is it?
14 started last year. And I know this because I've been watching reruns of Svennis. And that was a big thing. I mean, it's 14 guys. And, you know, here we have, we had to limit it finally to UCI points and then top 100 in Pro CX. And I think it, we still get 90 something people starting. So realistically, if we have a national series again, it'll probably benefit 14 guys.
Right. If that.
Which is, you know, I'm not saying that's a bad thing or a good thing. I'm not trying to like pass judgment on the top level guys wanting to make the sport better for them and make it better for spectators and better for fans that are following the sport. There's nothing wrong with that. I fully support their efforts. But it's also like, I don't know. I feel like sometimes some of that comes from looking at Belgium and seeing what they've built and trying to make that work over here, which doesn't work geographically.
No,
you know, it's
we're
like
much larger.
The Verge series makes sense, and it's so prestigious because it's in New England, and you have all these really, really top level guys that have won that series because they're from there. And the Max series, you know, used to be this big UCI series that was very prestigious. And like, remind me again why that went away. Wasn't it because like some guy that was promoting some national series was like, oh yeah, there's this obscure rule that like the UCI series only can be 8 races. Wasn't it something? There was like a bunch of drama that happened with that.
Yeah. I mean, that happened with the, that's why it was the Verge and the Shimano split. And then the Mac, that, you know, I can't remember all the details of it, but yeah, that
promoter
definitely,
drama.
Yes. Yeah. All right. So we solved that.
Well, we didn't solve it at all.
No, we didn't solve it.
No, not even a little bit. I think we talked about it. I mean, it's, there's good things and there's bad things. It's never going to be perfect. There's no way that we're going to have a national level series and at the same time grow like the base of the sport, the base being these like C2 regional events.
Right.
You know, it's like people can either throw all their weight behind like making this national series, or they can kind of, I don't know, race more regionally and like bring the, you know, it's like the sport in New England is so developed, you know, because there's so many people willing to put on UCI events within driving distance.
Right. And that's even at that level. And then you look, there's also some push in that most of the people racing just want to find a race. And there are so many grassroots series out there that aren't UCI at all.
Right.
So I don't know what you do about that either, because everybody, you know, the barrier to entry in putting on a cross race is really just a little bit of groundwork and finding a venue, and then you can really make it happen as long as you have people that are willing to travel and grow it. So it's a lot of people getting into the sport, a lot of older people getting into the sport. I mean, that's sort of the clash that I see, is that the sport really is, you know, aside from what you're trying to do, it's a masters and junior sport. That's where your growth is.
Right.
You know, this is where people want to try bike racing for the first time. Cyclocross has become the entrance point.
Which is awesome.
Yeah, it's absolutely awesome. But they don't need a UCI race at the end of the day.
No. No, they really don't.
So that's the other thing that I see, is like this sort of this conflict, is that you have all of these other series growing, and then you have these UCI. There's not enough days in the calendar, I think, is part of the problem. So I don't know, you know, and I know that I've heard rumors that some of the way to fix that not enough days in the calendar is to start getting rid of C2 races.
Yeah, I don't know if that's gonna fix anything. I mean, C1s are more expensive for the promoter to put on.
Absolutely.
I think if you tell people that they can't have a C2, they're not gonna, you know, they're just not gonna have. They might just not have a race.
Yeah.
You know, and like a lot of events have built their reputation on being a UCI event. I think there's a lot of. Okay, maybe there's not a lot of added value to people participating in the amateur fields. to be at a UCI event, but there's some. There's definitely some value to having the pros there. And
it makes it more of an event. It absolutely makes it more of an event.
It doesn't make their race necessarily better, but you know, it's kind of like going from an unsanctioned event to a USAC event. You know that there's like a certain amount of production work that's going to be there. When you go from just a regular USAC cross race to a UCI event, you know that it's going to be this other, like, slightly higher level. Yeah. You know, the same way that when you go to a C1, you know that there's going to be a lot of production.
Yeah, you know, in the same way that, you know, we can even see it from the race today. So somebody that did DCCX in the past, you know, one, they're not going over flyover. Two, it's even the little things that you don't even think about. They haven't done a race that has hard barricades anywhere on the course. So like the starting and the finishing stretch, you're coming down a professional finishing stretch.
Right.
Never happened in this region before this race, because, you know, it's mandatory for the to have a C2. So we had to go and, you know, put all of that in place. So that is something that in those, you know, USAC races that they're doing. That's really cool to have that experience. So that definitely is a, you know, some value added to,
sure,
that, to that race experience.
Sure, but then also, you know, it's like you guys are doing it now in this region. People see it, and then other promoters are going to be like, well, they did it, so why can't we do it? Which means that, you know, potentially somebody's going to be like, all right, we're going to add, you know, invest a little bit more into my USAC race, make it a little bit nicer, make it more like this other event that I went to that was a UCI event, and maybe down the road they want to put on a UCI. I don't know. I don't think more races is a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know, I get that people want to have like this figured out flow to the season, but I think ultimately it's, you just kind of have to pick and choose like what you want to spend your money on. Like, do you want to spend your money flying to the C1s? You know, is that what you want to spend your team budget on? Does that make sense for you as a team? Does that make sense for your sponsors? You know, or does it make sense to drive and hit the C2s and, you know, race as much as you can in your region and do the highest level of racing that you can in your region, but not necessarily care about the national ranking, you know?
So if we're talking about, should there be more or not more C1s or not as many C2s, how many World Cups should we have in the U.S.?
I don't care. I can't. I'm not going to get picked for the U.S. This is one of those things where, like, I remember, you know, it's like, I don't want to go to a World Cup because I want, you know, it's like, this is totally absurd because this is going to be an absurd statement. I don't want to go to a race that I feel like I should be racing in, even though I know in my heart of hearts that like I don't have any place in a World Cup field. But it's just like, I don't, you know, it's like, I don't want to go to a World Cup and watch like guys that I know and then be on the sidelines. That just makes me depressed. So it's like, no more World Cups. You can have it in Vegas. I'm never going to go to Vegas. It's just not going to happen. Do it there, and I can cheer on from the internet, and that's great. I don't know. It's cool that we had a World Cup. It really is. I don't.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, it's an issue that doesn't affect me at all, so I like have very little opinion on it. I couldn't care less if we had more World Cups.
What else in cyclocross do you have an opinion on?
Flyovers.
Let's talk about that. You do have opinion on flyovers. What do you? I
think in the U.S. in general, we build flyovers that are too small, which makes them too steep to either ride at slow speed, or, you know, too steep in the sense that if you hit them fast enough, you can kind of like fall off of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the exit ramp kind of like falls away from you way faster than a normal landing ramp should. So it's like, if you go off that lip fast enough, you can do something stupid. But you know, it's like, sometimes you need them in a course to make that work.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I don't know, as course crossings, I think flyovers make more sense for spectators.
Mm-hmm.
Put stairs on both sides. It's cool vantage point. People can cross on them. You know, somebody that's a race announcer can hang out up there, get a different vantage point of what's going on. I think in the race, it's like, unless you build them big, you know, particularly big enough for the lower categories to also be able to walk up them.
Yep.
Because it's like the juniors aren't, they're having a hard time. It's like people, you know, at Charm City, we saw videos of people like sliding down right. the flyover. Yeah. And it's like, it's kind of a mess. It's a cool course feature, but I don't know if it's like adding anything, you know, and like particularly at Providence, they like went flyover crazy,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it's like, there was two flyovers that were like very big, pretty well ramped, well-designed flyovers. On part of the course. And then there was one double flyover that was at the top of a hill, you know, and it seemed so obvious that it was like poorly thought out because it got steeper at the top.
Yeah.
Like, so you went most of the way up the flyover and then the last foot was like another couple of degrees steeper and you were just like, come on. So that was an instance where like, just let us race the course, build a flyover for the spectator course crossing,
mm-hmm.
and just like let everybody not have to deal with that, you know, because it was like a mess every race. People, you know, it was a log jam.
Is it in any way physically taxing after a number of laps to be going over a flyover of that size?
I mean, it's no more physically taxing than any other obstacle on the course. It's like, it's just another obstacle that you're like, you know, it's like a sand pit.
Mm-hmm.
You have to sprint at it. You can't get to it and then start pedaling hard. You have to set up for the obstacle ahead right. of time. So it's just another calculation you make in your mind. You're like, okay, I'm doing this 9 times. I have to be able to sprint here to make it over this flyover 9 times.
Yeah. I asked that question because I just, I know it was Drew Dillman who raced Valkenburg, which looks like an insanely hard course, said that the hardest part of that course was the flyover, because unlike what we're talking about here with these American flyovers, the flyover at Valkenburg was like a mountain. It was like 4 stories. You just kept climbing and climbing and climbing. It was like, you know, you were on there for 10, 15 seconds going up the thing until you got to the top. That, I think, is significant. That's,
oh, yeah.
That means something.
That will change the dynamic of right. a race if you add a 15, 20-second climb.
Yeah.
You know, for sure. But I think that, I mean, we just don't have
15 or 20 seconds might have been exaggerating a bit, but it was definitely,
it looked like a long flyover. I mean, I think if you need a flyover in your course to make it work, then build a flyover. Just make sure that it's like, you know, well thought out.
Right. I mean, it in some sense, it is a promoter's friend because it really does give you a lot more, real estate to work with.
Yes.
So you can really lengthen out a course. It's just doing it to do it.
Yeah, whenever I see instances of just gratuitous flyovers, I'm kind of like, we could have not had this here. But at the same time, you know, people love them. You know, it's like you look at if you look at the DCCX hashtag tonight, it's like, you know, videos of people airing out the flyover.
Yep.
And that's cool. You know, it's like more eyeballs looking at the yep. race, more people paying attention to the race. So it's like, I see both sides of it.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that's the thing with pretty much anything that has to do with this sport, is there's both sides to pretty much all the stories, all the arguments, you know, national series, no national series. There's two sides to that.
So is there anything, any one issue out
that
there?
That people all agree on?
No, that you would fix.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I'm not the right guy to ask this. You know, I'm just trying to race. I mean, equal payout mm-hmm. for women, professional women, and, you know, the elite women's fields should just be like, it should just be standard right. at every race.
Shouldn't even an issue.
So this is the thing. We have it really good in New England. New England has been doing equal payout for elite women for a long time.
Right.
And so it's almost something that I didn't,
you didn't know it was an issue other places.
Yeah. You know, and it's like, it's also, it's funny because like the UCI payouts became equal this year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they went from being 25 deep for men and 15 deep for women, I think, to 20 for everybody. And people didn't know about it.
Right.
You know, and I mean, that's another thing. When the UCI does something right, nobody hears about it because right. they're just terrible about getting any yeah. kind of information out.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's like people that are digging for all the things that the UCI does wrong, that's what we hear about. That's not to say that the UCI doesn't
you know, the
deserve
thing
that.
The thing that throws a lot of people when they're searching for UCI stuff is the .ch.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know who owns UCI.com, but that's not the place to go.
Since I am racing tomorrow.
Yeah.
We've talked
for a while.
How long have we been rambling?
1 hour and 10 minutes.
Yeah, fix that in post.
Yeah, we'll do that. But Dan, thank you very much. I think we both probably should get sleep. You at least can sleep in. I will be up in 5 hours or so to go do day two of DCCX.
You're gentleman and a scholar.
Well,
I don't even know what that means.
I don't either. But I enjoy talking to you, and let's do this again in the future.
Thank you for having me in your house.
Absolutely. Anytime. So there you go. That was Dan Chabanoff. Thanks a lot for tuning in to Crosshairs Radio. Follow along with all the things that Dan has to say on Twitter at Dan Chabanoff. You can also check out a weekly cross column that he does for The Athletic. It's available at theathleticcommunity.com/journal. Lots of great stuff. Sort of goes right along with the conversation that we had today with Dan, and you can get more there. As always, cxhairs.com, at cxhairs on Twitter, at cxhairs on Instagram. And if you want to spend some money and support the show, go to crosshairscycling.com/shop. Did you hear that? Was my voice cracking? It's been a long weekend. crosshairscycling.com/shop. See you next time.